Women have been playing football for more than 150 years, and it's always been political. Some have been celebrated, but others have been ridiculed, criticized, and forgotten. This is the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football.
I'm not going to the White House. No.
You know, there was a lot of critics talking about us, but we're back, so it's not been that long.
Give me the effing ball.
Playing like a girl means you're a badass.
Hi, welcome to the Forgotten 11. I'm Chris McGlynn. Today on the show, what if one sentence could change the world? But first, I hope you're well and washing your hands. Here at Forgotten 11 in Chicago, we've been under lockdown for 6 weeks, and I'm going a little nuts. But our governor has told us that staying at home works at stopping the disease. We were expecting something like 2 or 3 million sick people here, but our state has just 50,000. So if you're in a place that has this disease, please stay home. It works. Also, with the lockdown, it seems like my only work is this podcast. So if you like the show, please check out patreon.com/forgottenxi and make a donation. If you can't do that, follow the show on Twitter, forgottenxi. Share the show with your friends and on social media, and you can leave a review wherever you listen to the show. It really does help. Now, on to that one sentence. In 1921, the English FA banned women from playing football. That ban lasted 50 years until 1971. Over that same 50 years, on the other side of the Atlantic, American women had a completely different fight on their hands. And while it doesn't seem related to football at first, it really is. If you've ever wondered how or why the U.S. women are so good, this is part of that story. The United States was founded in 1776. And had its constitution, or basic laws, written in 1788. And that law said that all citizens could vote and everyone had equal rights. No, actually what it said was only white men who owned property could vote. Over the next almost 250 years, the people of the United States changed the law so that, very slowly, more people could vote. First, it was all white men. Then, in 1919, the law changed so that white women could vote. In the 1950s and 60s, black Americans demanded their right to vote, and they got that right with the Civil Rights Act. And then everyone was free and equal, and we all lived happily ever after. No. Okay, the reality is always more complicated. For most of the 20th century, there was something called separate but equal, which was just a fancy name for racial segregation. Eventually, laws and protests brought an end to that discrimination. But while the African-American community were fighting for and winning their rights, there was another civil rights movement happening. And it was just as important, but not quite as successful. Alice Paul was born in 1885 in New Jersey. She got a bachelor's degree in biology at Swarthmore College in 1905, and then a master's degree in economics and political science at the University of Pennsylvania in 1907. Women getting degrees at the time was fairly unusual. And then she decided to go to England to study at the University of Birmingham and the London School of Economics. And then her life took a bit of a different turn. She joined the English suffragist movement. Alice Paul learned about and participated in demonstrations, protests, civil disobedience, and hunger strikes. She was arrested many times in England and served several prison terms there. In 1910, she returned to the University of Pennsylvania and earned her PhD in sociology. By 1928, she had a doctorate in law. But back in 1913, she organized the Women's Suffrage Procession, which was the very first women's march. Millions of American women marched around the country for a constitutional amendment granting women the right to vote. In 1916, she founded the National Women's Party, which would eventually help get the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote passed and ratified in 1919 and 1920. Success. All done, right? Nope. Not by a long shot. On September 25th, 1921, the National Women's Party proposed another amendment to the Constitution that read, "No political, civil, or legal disabilities or inequalities on account of sex or on account of marriage, unless applying equally to both sexes, shall exist within the United States or any territory subject to the jurisdiction thereof." It was called the Equal Rights Amendment, or the ERA. The 19th Amendment passed in 1919 and guaranteed white women the right to vote, but nothing else. The ERA would give women all the other rights that men enjoyed. Equality can be a tricky thing. African Americans were completely denied their rights before the 1960s, but women were in a somewhat different position. In some cases, while women were denied rights, they were also given special protections, like protections from being overworked or special benefits for widows. If women had legal equality, would they lose those protections? Beginning in 1923, a version of the ERA was introduced in every Congress every year until 1972. And in 1972, this version passed. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. The problem, though, is amending the Constitution is difficult. You have to get 38 states to also agree to it, and the ERA had a deadline. By the time the deadline came in 1982, only 35 states had agreed to it. But there is some good news. There are now, in 2020, 38 states who have agreed. So they just have to have Congress vote again. Okay, well, it's a little more complicated than that. But there's more good news, and this brings us to football, finally. Title IX of the Patsy T. Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act. So, just to clarify, changing the Constitution is difficult. There are only 27 amendments, and the first 10 passed all at the same time. So it's only happened 26 times. But passing a new law is fairly easy. With it looking like the ERA would soon be law, the government decided to prepare for that with some new laws. In 1972, Congress passed the Patsy T. Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act, which includes Title IX. Title IX isn't really about football, or even sports. It's short, so I'll read it to you. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity that receives federal financial assistance. Now, if you don't know this, if you want to go to college, any college in the United States, you have to pay for it. And it's expensive. A university a short walk from the Forgotten 11 studio charges almost $100,000 a year, or nearly $400,000 for a degree. And that doesn't include living expenses. Now, most 18-year-olds don't have $500,000 laying around, so we take out loans. But who is going to loan an 18-year-old with no job $500,000? The federal government. And that means that every college and university in the whole country takes federal financial assistance. And that means that although the ERA didn't become law throughout the country, it did effectively become law at every college and university in the United States. What Title IX means for women is that they can get an education in anything they want. They can study medicine, or engineering, or law. But remember, the law says any education program or activity. And this is where we get to football. There are 20 million college and university students in the United States. And hundreds of thousands of young women play college sports. Also, high schools take money from the government. In the U.S., we don't have football clubs. Sure, we have a lot of teams, but they aren't clubs. They're businesses. I've mentioned this before, but bear with me for a moment. In most of the world, football clubs are part of a community. Clubs train kids to play. Some even feed and educate them. In the States, kids, or their parents, usually have to pay to play sports. But in university, and largely in high schools, the schools are required to pay for the sports, for men and women. And there are 20 million college students in the United States. So, remember, these schools can charge as much as $100,000 a year for each student, and that is a ton of money. Obviously, not all of it, or even most of it, goes to sports, but some of it does. Also in the U.S., we have something called sports scholarships. If you're good at a sport and agree to play for the college or university, they'll give you money for school. And that means, if you're a 12-year-old who's pretty good at sports, it's time to get serious. If you're a young girl who's good at soccer, that soccer scholarship could save you tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars on school. In the United States, there are over 9 million women and girls playing organized football. Most of them play for their college or their high school. While few will end up as pros, they are still playing and competing for the money that lets them go to school. This weird system where nearly all the players are playing for schools and competing against each other for money from the age of 12 or so means we have millions of young women, knowingly or not, with the dilemma of getting really good at a sport or not going to college. It may not be the best system in the world. There are plenty of problems, which I'll get into on some other episode. But I can tell you this. This is Sparta. In ancient Sparta, to become a citizen, you had to be a warrior. From a young age, they would teach the young boys how to fight, teach them to be strong. They'd beat them so they knew how to be hurt and then get it back up and fight. Sparta's citizenship test, they would take a boy out into the woods naked and leave him there, far from any town, so that he would have to fight the cold, the wild animals, find his own food, make his own weapons. If he survived and made it home, he was a citizen. In the United States, we have millions of young women playing to get that scholarship money, fighting on the pits so that they might pay a little less for college. But then, once you get that money, and you get into your school, you're not done. Not even close. If you really, really love your footy, you've got another trial. The National Women's Soccer League College Draft. So, you're good. Maybe the best on your college team. January comes around. You're probably starting your second semester in university. An agent calls you and tells you you're in the college draft. You might not be able to finish that semester. After competing so hard to get into a school and getting a football scholarship, the NWSL is now going to compete for you. Something like a ranked lottery between the teams. Now you're competing against the best women in the entire country. To get on the roster for the Chicago Red Stars, the Houston Dash, the Portland Thorns. There are just 9 teams in the NWSL, so only the best will even have the slightest chance. And you're still not done. Let's say in round 1 you get picked by the Orlando Pride. Great, you get to play with Marta and Alex Morgan. But in round 2, Orlando says, okay, you're good, but we don't need a left back, so we're going to trade you to North Carolina. Okay, North Carolina, reigning champions. But there are a lot more rounds. You have no idea where you'll end up until a coach calls you. Is your stomach in knots yet? Well, hold on. We're still not done. Just as an example, this is the story of Tierna Davidson. Last year, Tierna Davidson got drafted to the Chicago Red Stars. She was now a professional football player. No longer a Stanford University player. After competing against the best women in the country, she actually made it onto a pro team. But then she got a phone call. It was not what she was expecting. Really not what she was expecting. Jill Ellis, head coach of the U.S. women's team, called her to tell her she'd made the national team. She was going to the World Cup. The word system in the U.S., where the players start competing for money and for goals as children, created a team. That team, before they ever take to the pitch, are tough, and they know it. You might know these names, but ask yourself, why do you know these names? Michelle Akers, Brianna Scurry, Hope Solo, Brandi Chastain, Abby Wambach, Megan Rapinoe, Rose Lavelle, Carly Lloyd. Okay, if you're a soccer nut like me, you know them for the goals, the saves. You know them from the pitch. But if you're not a football nut, you know them for two other reasons. First, every one of them is a beneficiary of Title IX, and they owe their careers to the only law in the United States that grants women rights. Second, and just as important, the 37 words of Title IX created a culture in the school system of the United States where those women could express themselves, they could be confident in themselves, and they could say so. If you've never watched a match in your life, almost anywhere you live, you know the photos of Brandi Chastain ripping off her jersey when she won the 1999 World Cup. Rapinoe pumping her fist or arms stretched wide. You know that Hope Solo or Brianna Scurry won't hold back if you ask them their opinion. Title IX created a culture in American schools where girls were more equal. It taught people, myself included, that girls and women are your equal. Without question. Title IX has now taught generations of people in the United States that women can do anything men can do, and they deserve the same respect. Title IX also helped to create the U.S. Women's National Team, which, over the last decades, has raised the profile of the women's game. The U.S. team have inspired women around the world to take to the pitch, to stand up for their rights. To quote Abby Wambach, who is quoting Michelle Akers, "Give me the effing ball." Thanks for listening, as always. Don't forget to leave a review and share the show with your friends. Check the show notes for all sorts of neat things, including our Slack channel. I'll see you next time.